From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It's time for us to take a look at what school shootings mean for the nation, why they happen in the first place, and what might be done to prevent them so that we don't have to witness so many terrible tragedies.
Officials at Virginia Tech are planning a weekend commencement for graduating seniors that will honor the victims of last month's school shooting that left 32 people dead plus the shooter. We'll speak with sociology professor Catherine Newman about her book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Then the fallout continues from the police attack on the May Day immigration march in LA and the journalists who covered it. And we'll talk with writer and political analyst Michael Parenti about the culture struggle.
Every single culture, including our own, needs to be judged because within cultures are not neutral things. Some people benefit and other people can be victimized by culture.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iraq's infant mortality rate has soared by 150% since 1990, according to a new report by the charity Save the Children. One in eight Iraqi children now die of disease or violence before the age of five. In 2005 alone, 122,000 Iraqi children died before reaching their fifth birthday. Save the Children says Iraq's child survival is now ranking the lowest in the world. In other Iraq news, the country is facing a potential political crisis. Iraqi Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi has announced he will lead a withdrawal of Sunni politicians from the cabinet and parliament if changes are not made to Iraq's constitution by May 15th. Experts say the move could be a potentially devastating blow to reconciliation efforts within Iraq. Meanwhile, at least 68 people died in Iraq on Monday, including 13 in a pair of attacks on Ramadi. Earlier today, a powerful car bomb exploded in the Shiite city of Kufa. 16 people died. Another 70 were wounded. The Iraqi newspaper Azman is reporting today the residents of the Baghdad neighborhood Al-Azamiyah have vowed to destroy the wall that was built by U.S. forces to isolate the Sunni area from nearby neighborhoods. Residents of the area describe the structure as, quote, the wall of occupation. On Friday, a member of the 82nd Airborne was shot by a sniper while inspecting the wall in Baghdad. The soldier's in stable condition. In Kansas, the death toll from last week's tornado in the town of Greensburg has reached 9. Governor Kathleen Sebelius said the town is devastated.
There really are no businesses, very few residences, no school, no hospital. The community is pretty well gone.
Governor Sebelius said recovery efforts have been hampered because much of the state's National Guard personnel and equipment is in Iraq and Afghanistan. Kansas lacks about half the large equipment it could use for recovery efforts and debris removal, including dump trucks and front loaders. More than 20% of its Humvees and all but four of its helicopters were sent to Iraq. Kansas now has about 1,000 National Guard troops serving in Iraq, Afghanistan, and on the Mexican border. Sebelius said Kansas can't borrow equipment from other states because much of their equipment is in Iraq as well. Kansas has been forced to hire private contractors to help clear debris. A new survey by the Hill newspaper has found the majority of Democratic presidential candidates back increasing the size of the military. Last month, Senator Barack Obama called for an increase in Pentagon spending and an extra 65,000 soldiers and 27,000 Marines. Senators Hillary Clinton and Joseph Biden and former Senator John Edwards have also backed building a larger military. The Hill reports only two Democratic candidates, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson and Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, are openly discussing cutting the Pentagon's budget. Amnesty International has accused China and Russia of supplying arms to Sudan that are being used to attack civilians in Darfur in breach of a UN arms embargo. Amnesty has also accused two close U.S. allies, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, of supplying arms. Over 200,000 people have been killed in Darfur in recent years. Meanwhile, on Monday, officials from the United Nations and African Union met the head of the Arab League to discuss Darfur. This is Jan Eliasson, UN Special Envoy for Darfur.
Practically everyone we have talked to has said there is no military solution. And if they say that there is no military solution, there is only one logical conclusion, namely that there has to be a political settlement. So we will now hope to see all of the movements. We still have work to do in that respect, but hope that they will also be coming to those negotiations in good faith and be preparing themselves for real negotiations.
The New York Times is reporting the U.S. oil company Chevron is preparing to pay up to $30 million in fines for illegally paying kickbacks to Saddam Hussein for access to Iraq's oil before the U.S. invasion in 2003. The penalty, which is still being negotiated, would be the largest so far in the United States in connection with investigations of companies involved in the oil for food scandal. It appears Chevron began paying Iraq kickbacks in August 2000. At the time, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was a member of Chevron's board and led its public policy committee, which oversaw areas of potential political concerns for the company. Pressure is increasing on Paul Wolfowitz to resign as head of the World Bank. A high-level World Bank ethics panel has determined Wolfowitz broke bank rules by arranging a pay package and promotion for his girlfriend. On Monday, one of Wolfowitz's closest aides, Kevin Kellams, resigned. The New York Times reports European governments are trying to reach a deal with the Bush administration where Wolfowitz would soon resign and the U.S. would be allowed to pick the bank's next chief. Meanwhile, there's another story at the World Bank that's been overshadowed by the Wolfowitz scandal. Momentum is growing in Latin America to form an alternative to the U.S.-controlled World Bank. Venezuela and Argentina have already pledged more than $1 billion to start the Banco del Sur, or Bank of the South. Brazil, Bolivia, Ecuador, and Paraguay have all expressed support for the bank. This is Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
We're meeting all the ministers to discuss what's the goal of this bank. Is it a bank for financing? Is it a bank to develop the region? How will each country participate? In what way will we participate? So to create a bank, it's necessary for us to have sustainability in the idea. It's important for it to be a financial institution of much credibility, and for that, we need to resolve all political divergence that may exist about the bank.
Last week, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez announced Venezuela would pull out of the World Bank and the IMF.
We don't need to go to Washington, not to the IMF, nor to the World Bank, nor to anything. I want to formalize the exit of Venezuela from the World Bank, from the IMF, and from all of that. We don't need to have a governor or a representative there anymore. No, let's get out. We don't even want to be there, and they need to return our money to us because now they owe us.
In Los Angeles, two high-ranking police department commanders have been reassigned over their role in the police department's violent crushing of a lawful immigrant rights rally last week. Police dressed in riot gear fired 240 rounds of rubber bullets and tear gas. Officers were seen on video clubbing protesters and journalists with batons. Overall, 10 people, including 7 journalists, were taken to hospitals with injuries. On Sunday, the L.A. Police Chief, William Bratton, took 60 members of the police department's elite Metropolitan Division's B platoon off the street. We'll have more from Los Angeles later in the program. In news from Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee has asked a former Justice Department civil rights chief to answer accusations that he was a central figure in a broad Republican strategy to suppress the votes of minority voters. Former Justice Department civil rights lawyers have alleged the official, Bradley Schlossman, led a legal campaign aimed at making it harder for poor African Americans who tend to vote for Democrats to meet voting requirements. In media news, the Canadian company Thomson Corporation is in talks to buy the British news organization Reuters for nearly $18 billion. If the deal goes through, the merger would result in the world's largest news and financial data company. Investigative reporter Tim Shorrock of Salon.com has revealed that former CIA Director George Tenet has made at least $2.3 million since he left the agency by working for 4 corporations that are directly profiting from the so-called war on terror and the war in Iraq. Tenet did not disclose any of his corporate ties in his new book, At the Center of the Storm. Tenet sits on the board of directors of L1 Identity Solutions, a major supplier of biometric identification software used by the U.S. to monitor terrorists and insurgents in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tenet is also a member of an advisory board for Analysis Corporation, which is designing terrorist watch lists for the government. Tenet also serves on the boards of two other government contractors, Guidance Software and Kinetic. In Wisconsin, a former Marine recruiter has been sentenced to 1 year in jail and 3 years on probation after he was accused of sexually assaulting two high school students during a school recruiting trip. A 17-year-old girl said the Marine, Donnie Rage, groped her in his recruiting office and attempted to have sex with her at a party. One of the victims said, quote, "He had a gun in his room and he was forcefully telling me what to do and forcefully telling me how to do different things. I was scared and I felt I didn't have the right to leave the room." Last week, Rage pleaded guilty to one charge of false imprisonment. Prosecutors agreed to drop seven other charges as part of a plea deal. A new report from Amnesty International has revealed Native American women are more than 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted than women in the United States in general. Studies show that 1 in 3 Native American women will be raped during her lifetime. Amnesty said many rape cases are never prosecuted because there's confusion regarding tribal and county jurisdiction. It's estimated 86% of rapes against Native women are committed by non-Native men, but tribal councils have no jurisdiction over non-Native offenders, even if the crime takes place on tribal lands. And students at Harvard University have entered their sixth day of a hunger strike in support of a living wage and better working conditions for security officers at the school. About 11 students from the Student Labor Action Movement began the hunger strike in an effort to pressure the university to intervene in negotiations between the security officers and their employer, Allied Barton, which is one of the nation's largest contract security personnel companies. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Virginia has carried out the first change in policy to result from the deadly shooting of 32 people at Virginia Tech more than 3 weeks ago. On Monday, Virginia Governor Timothy Kaine issued an executive order requiring anyone forced to seek treatment for mental health to be added to a police database of people barred from buying guns. The order comes amidst the news state judicial and mental health officials failed to follow up on a ruling ordering Cho to get mental health treatment. The Washington Post reported a judge had found Cho, quote, mentally ill and in need of hospitalization in December of 2005, but no action was taken to ensure Cho receive the ordered care. My first guest is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. Catherine Newman is also lead author of a landmark study published as the book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Catherine Newman joins us now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy
Now! Thank you, Amy.
Talk about your thoughts right after the shooting took place.
Well, it was a very familiar story for me, I'm sorry to say, because having studied all of the school shootings that have occurred since 1970, the pattern in Cho's case was not really remarkably different, with the possible exception that it occurred in a university setting, which is very rare. Really, we have to go back to about 1966 and the Texas sniper case to find an incident of this kind on a university campus. But we have seen a spate of school shootings in high schools across the country, and the elements of this shooting were very similar.
Go through what you now understand as the day that all of this took place 3 weeks ago. And the evidence that you see as the stories come out on what was understood about Cho Sung-hui.
I think there's still many elements of what happened on that day that we are not entirely sure about, but it appears as though he got up very early in the morning, that he ended up shooting two people. His relationship to those two people is still unclear, but it does appear that he had some acquaintance with at least the girl that he shot. Then he went back to his room and assembled materials that he had been working on for some time, including the video materials that portrayed a portrait of himself he wanted to leave us with, which was very different from the self he actually represented in his daily life. And he went out and mailed those materials to one of our major news studios, came back, got his weapons together, went to the classroom building, which he barricaded, and then went methodically through classrooms shooting people with weapons that would allow him to shoot many at the same time. And he shot himself finally when he realized the police were on the way.
I think what has shocked so many people, among many other shocks, is that after he killed the first young man and woman in the dorm, that the university put out no warning and actually said they didn't think the shooter was a threat after that. They didn't even know where he was.
There are many unanswered questions that are going to be investigated on that campus, I'm sure. And I will say that most universities lack the capacity for automatic and immediate warning of all of their students and faculty. The same thing could have happened on my own campus, because it's not easy to contact students and faculty who are dispersed over so many buildings, so many places, off campus, on campus. I'm not excusing what happened there. I think they're going to take a very serious look. But apparently the police thought this was an incident that occurred in the dorm and the shooter had left the area. But obviously they should have secured the campus. I'm sure they wish they had.
And talk about the information we now have on how the university, how individual professors, particularly the English department, the chair of the English department, professors like Nikki Giovanni, the well-known poet and writer, had been seeking help for this young man for quite some time, had understood from the plays that he had written how violent he was, the turmoil inside.
The most tragic thing about the Virginia Tech case is that Cho was on everyone's radar screen. That is actually quite unusual, and the faculty was very proactive in seeking help for him, in trying to shield other students from his aberrant, violent tendencies. Honestly, I don't think the faculty could have done more than what they did do, and it's tragic that it didn't work, because in most cases, faculty are more limited in their actions, but they were
aware.
Explain
what they did.
Well, they first refused to teach him in a setting in which he could continue his violent ideation. They tried then to provide him with individual tutoring, and they did, the head of the English department did, to try and both coax him into treatment and to simply assist him in thinking through his situation and trying to calm him down. But most of all, they really tried to get him into mental health treatment. So too did his roommate, who called the police and tried to, again, get him into treatment. Everyone who connected with Cho attempted to do something for him to get him treatment or to simply remove him from a situation which they saw as increasingly threatening. He was ultimately, as you said, diagnosed as a danger to himself and to others, and therein lies a tale we will need to learn more about. Why did that not result in his being sent home for the protection of the rest of the campus? I don't really understand what happened there, because it would seem that the grounds were there to take such a dramatic action. We do protect people's civil liberties, and we don't take them away lightly, but in this particular instance, it would appear there were ample grounds to treat the situation differently.
I mean, the young women who were concerned when he was stalking them, either physically, individually, or on the internet, and his roommates, when there was concern expressed about this, he was actually taken away, taken from the dorm, taken to a mental institution.
That's exactly right. But apparently, he was ultimately declared treatable on an outpatient basis, and this seems to be the place where everything fell apart. And again, I think there's a great deal we don't know and will need to be investigated thoroughly, because he was so much more prominent on the radar screen than any of the other shooters I've studied, with the possible exception of one in Springfield, Oregon some years ago, who also was identified and one day away from being involuntarily committed before he shot his parents and others in his school. But Cho was really recognized for the danger he represented, but he was not ultimately segregated in a way that protected people.
Professor Newman, let's talk about the shooting rampages that you have studied in detail. First, how unusual are school shootings in the world?
They are, thankfully, very rare, but of course, when they happen, they're so devastating that they shake our sense of the normal and the real in the world and destabilize our sense of security. They are really relatively rare. Since 1970 in the United States, there have been about 25 such incidents. which is not trivial, but in the general scope of things, you are at greater risk probably crossing the street or getting into an airplane than you are of being hurt in a school shooting. And in fact, children are safer in school than almost anywhere else on the planet. Nonetheless, when these things happen, they're terrifying, and they appeared to increase in frequency in the 1990s.
More frequent in the United States than any place else in the world?
They are more frequent in the United States, but we don't have a monopoly on this. The worst school shooting ever before the Cho case occurred in Erfurt, Germany, where some 20 people were killed by a former student in a gymnasium there. So there have been cases around the world. There have been some terrible cases in Canada recently. We don't have a monopoly on this, but we do have this in a greater frequency.
Talk about the cases you looked at.
My research team studied two cases very carefully. One occurred in a very tiny town outside of Paducah, Kentucky, where a young man named Michael Carneal, at the age of 14, came into his high school and unleashed weapons on a prayer group that assembled every morning in his high school. And he killed three young women and injured a number of others before he was arrested. And he was subsequently diagnosed as a schizotypal personality disorder. Today he's in jail and will be till he's 45 years old. As I said, he was 14 when it happened. The other case we studied very closely took place again in a tiny town outside of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and this involved two shooters, one age 11, Andrew Golden, and the other age 13, Mitchell Johnson, who stole weapons from their families, drove a car to a ridge behind their school, came down and pulled the fire alarm, which caused all the children to exit onto a playground. By that time, they had positioned themselves on this hillside, and they just shot down into a bowl of children milling around, waiting for the fire alarm to be over. And they killed four kids and a teacher and wounded many others before they were themselves caught by the police.
And what warning signs were there in both of those cases?
School shooters are looking to gain the attention and affection of their peers, and so they never explode spontaneously. They do let out hints, sometimes for many months in advance. We found evidence of hints of what was coming in those two cases as long as 3 or 4 months before they actually happened, because what the shooter's trying to do is pique people's attention. And so they say things like, "I'm going to be running from the police. You won't see me for a while," or "We'll see who lives or dies on Monday." And these kinds of veiled hints or threats come at fairly rapid clip before the shootings happen. The problem for the kids who hear them is they don't really know exactly how to interpret what this means. And usually the shooter is someone who is known to be saying crazy things a lot of the time to get attention. The attention getting doesn't work until they start talking about school shootings. And when they start talking about shooting people, they start to get the kind of attention they crave. And then they have backed themselves into a corner, having made pronouncements about what they're going to do. And so even though they're usually deeply ambivalent about it, they go forward because what they're thinking about is, what will people think of me if I don't do what I said I was going to do? They're rarely thinking about the people they're going to kill or that they're going to kill anyone at all.
And what about the increasing violence in the culture? I mean, even the backdrop of war. I remember when President Clinton, after the Columbine shootings, said parents have to teach their children that violence is not the answer, that there are other ways to solve conflict, as the U.S. was dropping bombs on Yugoslavia. And then, of course, right now we have the Iraq War.
I think the connection between background violence and rampage school shootings is actually fairly complicated and not very straightforward. Violence is more prevalent in our nation's cities. School rampage shootings tend to happen in small, isolated rural communities or exurbs. So there isn't a very direct connection between where violence typically happens, especially gun violence in the United States, and where rampage shootings happen. But I do think there's a connection between what the media portrays and perhaps what the news portrays as heroic and masculine and forceful, and what school shooters come to think of as a better way of characterizing themselves publicly than the way they are actually appearing to their peers. There is an image thereafter that is more satisfying to them and more masculine to them than the sort of dweebish intellectual or outcast that they feel themselves to be.
Have the shooters and school shootings in this country always been boys?
Yes, they have been. Of course, girls do occasionally use weapons, but this kind of rampage shooting, which has a sort of random quality to it has actually never been carried out by a girl.
And right now, as you look forward, as parents, as kids are reflecting on what's going on in their own school, warning signs, what do you say to look for?
I think that kids need to know that these horrible tragedies really can happen. And so when they hear hints, threats, they need to be able to come forward to an adult they trust, because they are our best bet for prevention, because they are the early warning system. We will never be able to identify the kind of person who's going to do something like this. They are rarely like Cho, with all these warning signs being caught by people. Most of the time, they're flying very far under that radar screen. They are not the disciplined cases. They are not the people everyone thinks of as a troublemaker. They are the unknown, unexpected, and unidentified. But they do come forward with these threats and hints. And when that happens, the people who hear them need to know this could be serious, and they need to come forward to a trusted adult who will confidentially and privately look into the matter. If they don't see such an adult in their landscape, young people don't come forward, and they often don't feel that there's a trustworthy adult for them to turn to. And when that happens, we lose the best early warning system we have. And that's the thing that I emphasize when school districts ask me what they should do.
We're talking to Catherine Newman, professor of sociology, author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll also be joined by a representative of the Brady Center in Washington, D.C. They've come out with a new report. That's the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with Catherine Newman, who has written the book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Professor Newman, the letter from the family of Cho Sung-hui, the sister and the parents, can you talk about Cho in his family and what we understand about his sister as they talked about weeping for and with the world?
Well, it's clear the Cho family is completely devastated and, of course, never expected any such thing to happen. There are things about their son that they clearly were unaware of, but his troubled character is something that the family has known for some time. The reports from his aunts and uncles in Korea show that even at the age of 4, they thought he was very withdrawn and socially awkward, and they thought by coming to the United States, he might find a more open society and would do better than he had been in Korea. So there is some evidence that even as a young child, he was beginning the descent into the kind of madness that he's ultimately ended up displaying. But the family is a hardworking immigrant family. Obviously, education is important to them. Their older daughter, who was a student at my university at Princeton, obviously quite successful. And in this, they resemble the Carneal family, where the shooter was the younger brother of an extremely academically successful older sister, which can be a tension in any family. And there are thousands of families around the United States that experience this. But in a young man who is falling apart mentally, these kinds of pressures and strains, the experience he had in high school of being excluded and bullied, which is, again, not an untypical experience, but is magnified in the mind of someone who is losing his marbles, become strains that are unmanageable for him, and ultimately he exploded in this fashion. But this family has suffered a great deal. They, too, have lost someone dear to them, and there is no evidence at all that they knew they were harboring someone with such violent tendencies.
His sister, Sung Hui Cho, works with the State Department on Iraq reconstruction. And in that letter, they wrote, "We never could have envisioned that he was capable of so much violence. He has made the world weep. We are living a nightmare." I want to thank you very much for being with us, Catherine Newman, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, has written the book Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. As we turn now to Washington, D.C., joined on the line by Brian Siebel, the senior attorney with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, author of a new report that draws attention to the gun lobby's efforts in recent years to change college campus rules prohibiting firearms. It's called No Gun Left Behind, the Gun Lobby's Campaign to Push Guns into Colleges and Schools. Brian Siebel, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Talk about your findings today in this aftermath of the shootings at Virginia Tech.
Well, what we point out is we didn't even know who had been shot at Virginia Tech when several gun lobby organizations put out press releases calling for students and teachers on college campuses to be armed. You know, I think they would like it that to give everybody a gun and start the crossfire. I think that's their solution to this kind of tragedy. Of course, we totally disagree with that. And the report is designed to draw attention to their campaign. It follows on the heels of another campaign that the gun lobby has been pushing, which is to force guns into workplaces. They've supported bills in a number of states to bar employers from keeping guns out of employees' cars. We think that's, again, just a kind of foot-in-the-door effort that ultimately they would like to see guns essentially everywhere in society.
Can you talk about the law in Virginia and everything you understand about how Cho was able to get the guns that he used?
Well, you know, it's ironic that Virginia actually is probably the best state in the country in turning in mental health records to the instant background check system that we operate under. And yet they did not turn in the records for people who had been adjudicated mentally defective but not actually committed to an institution, which is the category that Cho fell into. He had a judge in December of 2005 had checked off a box after an evaluation that said he was a danger to himself and was mentally ill. And that disqualified him under the 1968 Gun Control Act. And that record should have been in the background check system that when he went to a gun store and tried to purchase the two handguns that he bought, should have turned him up as a person that would be denied. Now, of course, the unfortunate fact is that even had he been denied, he then could have gone down to a gun show in Virginia and bought a gun from a private seller without any questions being asked, with no background check being completed. So that really is kind of the huge loophole one of the huge loopholes in our country's laws, is that we don't have universal, thorough background checks whenever anyone tries to buy a gun. And I think we certainly need to get to that point if we want to begin to prevent people like Cho from buying guns in this country.
Now, Virginia has passed a new law, haven't they? But the gun shows are the loophole, even since the Virginia Tech shooting.
Yes, the gun show is a significant loophole in Virginia and most states, actually. There are about 19 states that have some form of universal background check, and that's the kind of system, like California, for example. If you are a private seller and you want to sell a gun to someone else, you have to go back to a dealership. The dealer then runs a check for a small fee. The dealer keeps the record of the sale, and, you know, the system is designed to, you know, prevent transfers to people who would otherwise fail a background check. When the background check actually has been immensely successful, there are about more than 1,300,000 people have been denied at gun dealerships from being able to buy a gun. And immediately after that law was passed in the early 90s, until recently, gun crime came down almost basically every year. Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, we've seen a sharp uptick in gun violence. But the law had been very effective. The problem is it needs to be made more comprehensive so that anyone who has a felony record, who has been adjudicated mentally defective like Cho, would actually be denied a sale, not only at a gun store, but in private transactions as well. I mean, of course, the problem with the mental health records is that very few states a lot of states don't even put any records in their system. It's ironic, as I said, Virginia had among the probably the best system, and yet even there, Cho fell through the cracks.
We're talking to Brian Siebel, senior attorney with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. They have just put out a report, No Gun Left Behind, the gun lobby's campaign to push guns into colleges and schools. Talk more about the gun lobby effort in the schools and what you have found that's new in this report.
Well, one of the things we published is the NRA put out a letter in Maine. The state of Maine, actually the colleges there have policies against guns on campus, but there was some lack of clarity in the law, and so the institutions were seeking a law essentially supporting their position that they can control guns on campus. The NRA put out a letter opposing this, claiming that under the preemption law in Maine that the college already had no right to bar guns from campus. And then the other day, after this shooting, Wayne LaPierre wrote an editorial in the USA Today where he says, every option should be put on the table to protect our children at school, which to us, in light of this letter, suggests that the NRA is supporting prohibiting colleges and universities from barring guns on campus. The NRA supported a law in Utah, it's actually the only law of its kind in the country at this point, that prohibits universities and colleges in Utah from controlling firearms on campus. And so we believe that they have essentially made it clear that that's the direction they would like this country to go in, that colleges and schools would be prohibited from barring guns, and therefore anyone who could otherwise possess a firearm would be able to do so on campus. To us, that's a recipe for disaster.
Can you talk about gun-filled zones?
Well, I mean, again, their notion here that this is to us a multi-step campaign. About 20 years ago in the state of Florida, they pushed for expanding concealed carry laws to take the discretion out of law enforcement from being able to prohibit people from carrying guns around. They've continued to push that now with a campaign to force guns into workplaces, and now they would like to essentially arm students and teachers. And if college students can be armed, then I think in their eyes, certainly workers could be armed. And I think that the overall campaign is to prohibit anyone from being able to set rules that prohibit guns from being on their premises, whether it's workplaces or colleges and schools. And one of the things we talk about in the report is all the reasons why that would be a terrible idea. Drugs and alcohol are prevalent, unfortunately, on college campuses. The risk of suicide is very real. It would increase the risk of gun theft and so forth. So there's a host of reasons why this would be a rather dangerous idea and would certainly increase the risk to students.
Brian Siebel, I want to thank you for being with us, senior attorney with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. We will link to your report, No Gun Left Behind, the Gun Lobby's Campaign to Push Guns into Colleges and Schools. When we come back from break, we will go to Los Angeles, where the fallout continues from the police attack on the May Day immigration march, the attack on the marchers and the journalists. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. Pistolera here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Los Angeles, the fallout continues from the police attack on the May Day immigration march. Police with riot guns fired hundreds of rubber bullets, shot tear gas, and club protesters and journalists gathered in MacArthur Park. At least 10 people were injured, including 7 journalists. On Monday, the Los Angeles Police Department Chief William Bratton announced the demotion of 2 high-ranking officers involved in the police response. Deputy Chief Kaylor Lee Carter Jr. of the Operations Central Bureau and his number 2, Commander Lewis Gray, were reassigned. Meanwhile, up to 60 officers in the Metropolitan Division's Elite B platoon have been taken off the streets, most of them permanently. The move comes as city officials offer their strongest apology to date. Los Angeles Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa said, quote, accountability begins at the top. What happened on May 1st was wrong. My next guest is a veteran Los Angeles civil rights attorney with firsthand experience of police brutality both in and outside the courtroom. Carol Sobel is president of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. In 2000, she was hit by police pellets while serving as a legal observer and negotiator at the protests outside the Democratic National Convention. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carol Sobel.
Thank you.
Talk about the latest developments and the demotion of these 2 top commanders as a result of the attack on the protesters and the journalists.
Well, I think that the mayor, certainly, and the police chief are attempting to defuse the situation. And the 2 people involved were the commanders at the incident. The irony for me in particular is that the commander, Commander Gray, who was relieved of duty yesterday, or reassigned from Central Division at least, was the individual who gave the order to shoot people with less lethal weapons in October 22, 2000. And, you know, the city wound up paying a little over $1 million for all the cases that resulted from that. Here we are 7 years later, and the very same person gives the order again. So it's pretty remarkable. I think that the transfers were probably warranted in this instance.
Talk about what is understood at this point about what happened on May Day, about how this attack took place, and also the surprise of it being on the journalists with the hefty cameras, journalists that were standing in place doing their stand-ups in front of the protest, very clearly identified. These police knew they were on camera.
Well, they knew they were on camera, but I think what's sort of extraordinary here is that as we get further and further away from the actual May Day events, the number of people who are alleged to have caused the police reaction keeps dropping. We started with Chief Bratton saying there were 50 to 100, quote, agitators, either agitators, anarchists, or communists, depending upon what day of the week it is that he's talking about it. But that number is now down to 30 from the police chief. And I'm willing to put money on the fact that by next week at the latest, that number will be down to about 10 people. And quite frankly, what happened is when the police decided to sweep the park and close it down, there was no one that was doing anything more than heckling them. And they were, I wouldn't say heckling even, I would say criticizing them. And they were doing it because what happened during the course of this march is that the police wanted to open up a street. And rather than talking to people and saying, can you move on to the sidewalk, can you move into the park now, what they did was run their motorcycles into women and children in the Aztec dancers group who were in the street at that point still. And the street was closed to traffic, but they were in the street performing their ritual circle dance at the end of the march. And so, you know, you have the police doing one of the most provocative things they could do, and all of a sudden it is the fault of the demonstrators when the police literally use their motorcycles to strike people as a means of crowd control and to strike women and children as a means of crowd control when people were peaceful.
The story of Pedro Sevcik, who's very well known, broadcasting live for the Spanish language television network Telemundo. Police knocked over his monitors and the lights, hit the staff with batons.
Well, at that point, you know, they decided that everybody was going to be out of the park. And this was a decision by Metro Division. Under the Democratic National Convention litigation that occurred in 2000, we had two settlement agreements. One applied to the press, one applied to how they would do crowd control with demonstrators. The agreement with the press required them to set aside an area where the press could be and could conduct their interviews and cover the events. And they did that for the morning march, but they never did that for the afternoon march. And that was up to the commanders. That was up to Deputy Chief Carter. That was up to Commander Gray to make sure that someone did that and set aside a place for the press. The press weren't in their way. I mean, this is just a situation where the police department just decided anybody in the park was going to be subject to their brutality. And in a couple of instances, I know there's particular outrage about the press, but, you know, Chief Bratton's response initially was, well, how can you tell who's the press and who's not the press? Everybody has a camera these days. That's not the issue, because just because a person has a camera doesn't mean they're doing anything unlawful. So press or no press, they shouldn't have assaulted them. But the particular concern here is that there are rules within the LAPD about how you set up a press area. And they just didn't care. I mean, they just, you know, if a press person was knocked down, they struck him with a baton to get him up. If the cameraman got knocked down and the reporter tried to help him up, they beat the cameraman and the reporter. It was just, it was senseless.
We're talking to Carol Sobel, who's a California civil rights attorney, president of the L.A. chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. She herself was hit with, was it pellets, rubber bullets,
no,
in 2000?
It's a stinger round. It's a hard rubber ball. It's not a pellet.
Now, Mayor Villaraigosa was in El Salvador when this happened. What is your assessment of his response at this point? Do you also see the police commissioner, Bratton, going down? He's the former commissioner of New York.
I'm sorry, Amy, did I see him going down?
Yeah, do you see Bratton being fired or resigning?
No, I don't think so. I can say with probably relative certainty, Bratton is not going to be fired. And I don't believe that Bratton... I just don't believe he's going to be fired over this at all. What's been remarkable is the response of Bratton, which I think is different than the response of the last most of the last police chiefs in this city, which would have been to say, "My officers did nothing wrong, and we will investigate." And instead, Bratton has said, "This is bad. People did things wrong, and we will investigate." And that is such a marked change for us. Now, I'm not saying that that Bill Bratton is the best police chief Los Angeles has ever had. I'm not saying that by any means. And I'm certainly, I have no appreciation for Bill Bratton's police tactics on the homeless in this city. Or any other city, and there are other issues as well. But this is a marked difference in the city from what has happened in the past when there's been a police shooting, when there's been a police beating. It was always exonerate the officers and then ask questions. And in this instance, that's not occurring. And I think that is, I think for those reasons and for other reasons, Bratton is not going to be he is going to be renewed.
Do you think this shows the power of the press when the press is in the right place, when the press is on the ground with their cameras focused?
It does show the power of the press, but and I think it's incredibly important that the press was there to cover this, that the community was there to cover this. I do have to say, though, as somebody who's usually on the other end of the police officer's stick, I think that I wish the press were as outraged when it was just the demonstrators who were subject to that brutality.
Well, Carol Sobel, we're going to leave it there, and I thank you for being with us, president of the LA chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Thank you, Amy.
As we turn now to our last segment, we end today's program with the words of the writer, political analyst, social critic Michael Perrenny, author of more than 20 books, including Democracy for the Few, Super Patriotism, Now the Culture Struggle. Michael Perrenny joined us in our Firehouse studio yesterday for a conversation about the war in Iraq, democracy in the U.S., and what he calls gentleman imperialists. I began by asking him about his assessment of where we stand right now.
The war has destroyed Iraq, and the war has already created a bloodbath. Bush said we can't leave because there'll be a bloodbath. The bloodbath is now. It's going on now. I heard the same thing for 10 years about Vietnam. We can't leave. There's going to be a bloodbath. Well, in fact, when we left Vietnam, the bombings stopped, the Agent Orange spraying stopped, the napalming and killing people stopped, the Phoenix CIA assassination program stopped. The bloodletting stopped, and I think the same thing would happen in Iraq. That's my assessment.
What ended the Vietnam War?
U.S. withdrawal, and I mean, why they withdrew, it just became so untenable and unpopular in the U.S. It seemed endless. There seemed no out. And I think that's the same thing that's happening here. You've seen within the last 6 or 7 months in Congress, it's amazing, and in the country, where before they were hesitant to say, oh, I'm not sure we want to get out, or they're all now saying it, and they realize most of the American public wants to get out. Bush no longer uses the term stay the course. They discovered that stay the course, the American public was rejecting it because it had a kind of endless quality. There was no exit to it, you know, this stay the course. So they've dropped it. They never use it anymore. They know they themselves are in a dead end here.
Can you talk about how culture fits into this story? You've just written a new book, one of your many. This is called The Culture Struggle. Why focus on culture now?
I found that culture is a highly contested area. There are immense and important struggles going on all over the world in regard to culture. And what we're taught is an enlightened view that in reaction to cultural supremacism and cultural imperialism, we're taught that we shouldn't really judge cultures. And yet, every single culture, including our own, needs to be judged because within cultures are not neutral things. Some people benefit and other people can be victimized by culture. One of the greatest victims, universal victims, of just about all cultures in the world are women, for instance. And the more I went into this, the more I realized how that was true. And by victimized, I don't mean job opportunities only or life roles or this. But in sheer physical survival, the amount of harm and abuse and violence that is delivered upon women in all cultures is really horrifying. And it seems to me, there are some village cultures in Central Asia, in the Middle East, and some parts elsewhere, other places in the world, where if a young woman is raped, her father then kills her to restore the honor of his family. I mean, this is what we're facing. And even in our own culture, the violence against women in this culture is pandemic. And I think much of feminism, which is so focused on lifestyle issues, personal expression, personal development issues, which are all important and good issues, I think maybe much more militant attention should be directed to this issue.
You talk about the mass marketing of culture.
Yes. Well, there we see that we create less and less of our culture. The little bits we do create we call folk culture, and even some of that is marketed.
What do you mean?
Well, there's folk song, which means songs that are created by the folk, and yet a lot of that gets onto CDs and is put out there like any other music industry product. So more and more of our music, more and more of our storytelling, more and more of our experience is now media produced, and it's something we buy much of our culture instead of just creating it now.
And psychiatry, you talk about psychiatry as a control weapon.
Yes, that Well, psychiatry has always had a history of pretending to be purely scientific, and it's rather riddled with all sorts of conventional and elitist values of one kind or another. We know how psychiatry has treated women. Psychiatrists back in the antebellum days used to talk about slaves suffering from a disease called drapetomania, and it was the irresistible impulse to run away from their slavery. And this was seen as a psychological maladjustment and such. For generations, right up until the 1970s, homosexuality was treated as a sickness that had to be treated in some way. And today, the American Psychiatric Association has reversed their position and say it isn't a sickness. Well, both those positions were arrived at in non-scientific ways. The first was just part of a homophobic culture, and the second was in response to the political activism of gays who said, stop it, this is a form of oppression upon us.
Cultural imperialism?
Cultural imperialism just shows that imperialism doesn't work alone. When a power or conquering force goes into an area, it then it then brings in its own holy men and its own standards and its own cultural styles and life to impose on the people, to the extent that it serves the colonizing power. And behind cultural imperialism is ethnocentrism, the presumption that we are, after all, a superior culture to you, and so we'll come in and we'll show you how you really should be living. You get some of that in the present Iraq war. There's a presumption that this 5,000-year-old civilization, the one that invented writing and all sorts of other things, needs the guidance of the Bush White House in learning what democracy is about. And that's the biggest joke of the day. You didn't even crack a smile. All right, and that's a perfect example of cultural imperialism, especially since the Iraqis had a democratic revolution back in 1958, which was slowly undermined by the right wing of the Ba'athist Party under Saddam Hussein, who himself was getting aid and being brought along by the CIA. That's a part that the major media has totally dropped down the memory hole, and we never hear about it.
Michael Parenti, author of The Culture Struggle. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a DVD copy of the broadcast or see the transcript or listen by audio stream or podcast at video or audio, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Jen Utes, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Thanks also to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Hugh Grand, John Randolph, Jerome Bourgeois, Jose Miranda, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, and Samantha Chamblay. If you want to sign up for our daily headlines and news segments, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.